Thanks. And just to recap a couple of things that we did talk about last time, because there are a couple of people here maybe who were not here last time. He's trying to read a text that is repeated three times in the existing Upanishads, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, and the Kaushitaka Upanishad. And this is the encounter between Shvetaketu, his father, Uddalaka, and a king who is named differently, but in the two main ones of Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, he is called Pravahana Jaivali. As I said last time, I'm trying to approach this from a literary point of view rather than a theological, although the literary approach that we are trying to do discloses quite frequently the kinds of ideologies or theologies that may underlie the way a particular author has sought to present and the changes in the languages that author brings into the text may throw light on their own ideologies. It involves, therefore, close reading of the text, and that's sort of the best of philology, paying attention to being conscious of the word selection, the way author expresses himself, and as I said last time, this is the least we can do in terms of paying our respects to these people who have left us this monumental text of the past. The courtesy we owe them is to read what they write, to know the language in which they write, and to read what they write carefully. One other thing is, as we look at it, is the importance of context. Importance of context. In other words, it's difficult to read any one sentence or even any one paragraph in isolation. It is embedded in a broader discourse, and we will need to look at that discourse. We will not do it immediately today, but in the first part of this little article of mine, I try to survey the entire chapter within which this is embedded and how this fits into the larger discourse within which the author of the Upanishad works. So that's the other thing. And one of the things that we try to do is to go beyond the traditional view of, quote, the Upanishadic philosophy. That's a sort of the kind of early Indological research that produced this kind of a distilled version of, there must be something that the Upanishads are trying to tell us. Upanishads in the plural, as if it were a single voice that is speaking to us. This you find in the famous book of Doyson, called The Philosophy of the Upanishads, which tries to tell, this is what the Upanishads tell us, as if there was one thing that the Upanishads were trying to tell. And we are trying to get away from that to say that the Upanishads were composed over a long period of time, centuries. So it's very difficult to say that Charles Dickens and somebody writing today in the United Kingdom would be saying the same thing. Their interests would have been different, their needs would have been different, their audience would have been different. So we expect them to be saying different things, although there may be continuities. We may be speaking in English, for example, and therefore there's a certain continuity in that. But within the continuity, there's also a great deal of variety. Finally, before we try to read some of these, to show, especially in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the largest of the Upanishads we have, which is the last portion of the Shatapatha Brahmana, which is a huge Brahmana text, the longest we have. You may have it somewhere here, I guess. I mean, it goes into about six or seven volumes of the Sacred Books of the East, so it's quite a large. But they come from the Yajurveda tradition, Yajurveda being the Veda within which you find the Advaryu priest, who is the specialized priest mainly involved in actually performing the sacrifice, the physical actions of killing the animal, of cutting the animal, of putting stuff into the fire and all of that, the Yajurveda tradition. And it appears to have, and I wrote an article many years ago on the term Anand, which is a common term in Sanskrit, to some degree in Buddhism, because the Buddha's favorite disciple was called Anand, and try to find out the meaning, early meaning of Anand, and its connection to sexuality. My conclusion there was that Ananda is a neologism. It doesn't exist in the early period of Indian history. It comes into being at a particular time, and mostly within the Ayurvedic tradition. It's not found elsewhere. It is not used as a religious concept within the religious discourse, either in Buddhism or Jainism. It is not found in Pali, even though the name Ananda is there, but they don't use it as a term in the discourse. Not found in Jainism, not found for the most part in non-Yajurvedic texts. And this is interesting in the sense that chapter 6 of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is all about sex, and sexuality, and the evaluation or re-evaluation of what sex means runs through as a thread throughout the sixth chapter. And towards the end of the sixth chapter, and I sort of, if you have this text, you can, my write-up here, paper, you can read that. Towards the end of this, you find this whole area of how to get, if you have sex, how to not to conceive, birth control, how to have a female child, how to have a male child, how to have a variety of kinds of children, fair ones, dark ones, etc. And how, I mean, there's this tremendous male fear of the female, that the female during sex could draw your vital energies out into her. How to prevent that? And so this whole thing, your sixth chapter, is about sex. And this is embedded within that. And we can see, and as we read it, some amount of sexuality already here. But when you go to read the thing that we don't have here, which is the actual theory of five fires, which shows the rebirth process, it's all viewed as a sacrifice. Ahuti. That's something that you throw in the fire. And so you have various cosmic and physical actions like rain, like cremation, all interpreted in ritual terms. So ritual interpretations argument. And finally, the act of sex is viewed as, again, an offering. So we'll see a little bit of that here. Okay? So when we read it, and since we have quite a few people, I won't ask you all to read it, but I will read it and try to translate it and follow with me, and please interrupt me, question me, and because we are a small group here and we are all equals here, so you can just jump in, okay? So don't put your hands up, just shout, like my students do. Americans are. Yeah. All right. So we had earlier Shweta Ketu come in, number one here, and these numbers are given by me, so that we don't need to carry any. So this is page 54, if you have your thing. So Shweta Ketu goes to the Panchala. Number two here, as you can see, is found in only in the Brihadaranyaka. The other two, Kaushitaki and the Chandogya, don't have that. Sa ajagama jaivaling pravahanam paricharayamanam. I talked last time about this term paricharayamanam, which indicates that he was being served upon, and the other places this word occurs in the Upanishads show some amount of sexual connections. So a maid conceives a child as she was paricharyamana, as she was going from place to place to do her maid work. And of course, she was taken advantage and she conceived a child. So it could be at some level that the king is being served, probably by women, either sexually or in a more social context, right? What is interesting here is that what Chandogya and Kaushitika does not do is that this sets the scene for the uncivilized behavior of Shvetaketu. It's interesting that Brihadaranyaka presents Shvetaketu in much worse light, as we read this, than Chandogya. Chandogya seems to somehow or other cut him a little, you know, those there. Okay. Is that okay? Sorry to that. Yeah. So then, in 3, we find, in the Brihadaranyaka, Tam Udikshya Abhi Uvad Kumara Iti. The 3 is sort of a, it's a sort of thing, greeting, right? So you elongate the last word, you know, Kumara Iti. Having noticed him, Udikshya, he sort of saw he's coming over there, Udikshya, Abhiuvad, very, very interesting term, meaning that he was, has the term, I discussed this on page 58 here, which has a meaning of Abhiuvad, respectful greeting, you know. He greeted him respectfully, and maybe with affection. A term that is not found in Chandogya or in Kaushitika. So it's that the king was a gentle king, was trying to greet this young man who had just barged into his presence with some amount of civility, respect, and love. And the word Kumara at the end itself can have the meaning of Kumara is a prince to begin with, right? So it's a young man, but it appears to have some amount of respect and love there. Okay, when we go to Chandogya, the next okay, are you following me? Next column there. Tangha pravahanang jaivalir vacha. Vacha versus abhyuvada, right? Why? He told him immediately, right? In other words, none of these introductions. No, he comes into the thing and Jaivali just immediately asks him a question. Like a superior questioning an inferior. Okay? And the word Kumara is there, but if I think Kumara is syntactically connected to what follows in 5. So it seems like at the beginning of a sentence, young man, can you tell me? Rather than here, hi young fella, how are you? The two very different things, right? So when you go to Kaushitaki, the situation is very different. Because, as I said last time in one, Uddalaka was asked to come and perform a sacrifice for the king. Uddalaka said, I'm too busy, I'll send my son. So son comes over here, and he comes, and this is what happens. Tam ha asinam, him, as he was seated, papracha, he asked, Gautamasya putra, the son of Gautama, that too, is syntactically connected to 7 in this one. So again, a beginning of a question. So you have two beginnings of a question and the other actually a greeting. So it's very interesting. Even though the words are in the vocative, Kumara, but here you have Kumara, which is a long thing, which is the beginning, the end of a greeting. Yes, of course. Don't say, can I?
The pluta, the kumara, this prolongation of the could this be a form of degradation towards someone, or is it just hello?
Like, yes, hello. It's the pluta is always at the end of a when you say bho, we have this bho quite frequently. You know, bho is a bho. There's no way to put it into English. Mm-hmm. It's something like hello, dear, boy, you know, if you're telling you, hello boy, how are you, and that kind of thing. There's all those things come. Bho is used both with from a teacher to a pupil, but from a pupil to a teacher too. So it does not have the connection of a superior inferior. It's more of an endearment kind of thing. There also you have this Plutha coming in at the end, and all greetings are supposed to have Plutha at the end.
The reason I ask is because of the story with Udalaka, in the Brihadaranyaka, with Yajnavalkya and the other seers, the contest of Vidya.
Right, fourth chapter. Yeah.
Udalaka comes to Yajnavalkya and he says. Yajnavalkya. Ask a question.
Yes, exactly.
That is really like a test.
Yes, yes, of course.
So I always thought it's like it gives this amount of tension to the conversation between the two.
I don't think so. I mean, context may do that,
yeah.
But Plutha is used in greeting. That's the normal thing,
from
in greeting.
From a distance.
Yeah, from a distance too, right, yes. Yes. And you are so you can project it, you know. If you go to the Dharmashastras or Dharma Sutras, there's all these rules about greeting. And they tell you how to greet. And there too you have the Plutha coming at the end. Yeah. Okay? All right. Then number four then, which is again not found anywhere else in the Brihadaranyaka only, sa bho, again a Plutha there, bho iti prati shushrava. He replied, bho. Now I recognize that bho could be used in many contexts, but it appears that this kid is doing something not proper with regard to a king. Bho is an informal, familiar greeting to each other, right? Not a more a formal greeting that a person should pay to a king, especially when you are a young man after all, right? It's like English saying, hey, rather than sir, right? You'd say so. So this, I think, although I can't be... each one I'm trying to get here can be explained away. But I think it's a cumulative thing that makes my interpretation, I think, probably true. Bho. That is not found here. So in a sense, he says, Kumara, he says Bho. So that conversation, it was not there in other things. Because Jaivili is speaking all the time. There's no give and take there. Okay? All right. When we come to five... now here the question of Jaivali. Anu shishto nu asi pitra iti. Anu shishto nu asi. Have you been anushishta by your father? Anushishta is an interesting term. Shishta is a common term in later Sanskrit, occurs in Patanjali and others. As a class of people who are educated, who are virtuous, and who become an elite Brahmanical community, who become authoritative. How they speak, what they do, become authoritative with regard to to other speech and dharmic communities. Right? That's a dharma. So, anushishta here, anu with shesh or shas, to mean to, I would say something like educate, not just teach. In other words, it's more than imparting information. It's training a person to be a full member of an educated adult community. And he used the word anushishta. If you go to Chandogya, you have anu tva ashishat pita iti. Did your pita, father, do... The anu shish, na anu tva ashishat. This is an old Vedic themesis, what's called, where the prefix, a preverb, is separated, just like in German, from the verb itself. That's the anu, and separated by tva, you, ashishat. Renato Sernan has used this to show that Chandogya is probably the older. I'm not completely sure of that, but I think that Tva Ashishat is neutral. Did your father educate you? And I think Anushishta, the word, the past participle has been used, carries with it a certain cultural baggage, the way the verb itself does not. Okay? And in other words, he's saying, are you an educated person? As opposed to, did your father teach you?
Is there a sort of little reflection of how he answers?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay? This is the ironic thing. Have you been educated by your father? It's a little you barges in here and say, hey, to me. Okay? And you are ignorant too. We will see later on that he becomes ignorant too. So it's a very interesting and a person who is listening to Anushishto, you know, has a little smile on it, right? I mean, you talk about an audience that is reading this.
Can I ask?
Yes, of course.
Is the suggestion that by the time this particular version has been written, there is a more concretized sense of Ashishta,
yes,
as a particularly virtuous elite of Brahmins who all understand what virtue and culture and civility and learning mean.
Right. Either it is, or it is very close to that.
Right.
I mean, Ashishta is a rather late term with,
yes,
that meaning,
yes,
right? But I think you're beginning to see that here, right. Anushishta, yes, you know, using, the guy in Brihadaranya could as well, he knew his Sanskrit, he could easily have used the verb, you know, but he chose not to. That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe I'm being too picky, you know, but I just want to pay attention to the kinds of choices the person is making, right? And the choices, if we had only the Brihadaranyaka version, we could not have made much of it. Because we have now two versions, we can say, well, there was another version, right? And some people think that's an older version. If it was, I'm not sure whether it was old. If it was, then why did he change it? What message was he trying to communicate through that? So that's what I'm asking here. Yeah.
That word is also connected with the Shishya word, isn't it?
Yes. It's all from the verb Shish and Shas, right? Mm-hmm. To educate.
Mm-hmm.
Shishya is future potential, which means one who should be educated,
mm-hmm,
needs to be educated,
the
right? Then you have Shishta, one who has been educated. You get the Shastra, you know, that by which you educate is instrumental. Okay, so there's a whole host of Sanskrit terms coming from that, all within the educative field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
specifically dharmic also.
Yes, dharmic and speech. And the way Patanjali, who is the grammarian, uses it is, how do you know, where do you find good Sanskrit? Right? It's like asking here, probably not today, but maybe 100 years ago, where do you find good English? They say, go to Oxford. You know, you know, listen how the professors speak there, and then you get good English. Something like that, right? The Shishta. You find that in Patanjali, now that you talk about the mid of the second century, sometime later than this, probably. You find also the Shishtas are geographically located. So you have a sacred geography coming called the Aryavarta. Aryavarta is determined. So these good guys live in a particular area, like Oxford, right? A geographic place. All right.
There's a question about...
Yes, of course.
So Ashishat is an aorist. And
yes.
It could be old, and it could be older than the Brihadaranyaka.
Absolutely.
But
right.
I think the argument might be that if there's going to be a change of from, it's going to be from Ashishat to Anushishto, as opposed to the other way around, just because that construction,
yes,
replaces finite verbs in Sanskrit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now that's probably true. Probably. What we do not know, of course, is that what was the... Where the problem is, what is the source of the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya versions? You know, in all likelihood, Brihadaranyaka is not dependent on Chandogya, and Chandogya is not dependent on Brihadaranyaka. So they both draw on a common source that may have, you know, existed in multiple versions already. We do not know whether it was a single version, because these are stories, right? And we know stories are repeated in different ways. So folklore is a better model for understanding this than, you know, philology. So yes, linguistic form, clearly Anushishta is a later form, you know, because it's the past participle, and past participle becomes more common in later Sanskrit as the language becomes nominal rather than verbal, right? And my problem with Renata is that from there she argues for the entire Chandogya version being older. That is a jump that it's problematic. Yep. Okay. We go to 6. In the Brihadaranyaka, by the way, all this is omitted in the Kaushitake. Okay. He questions and he asks. So Shvetaketu doesn't enter into the picture. This whole thing. Right? On 6, he says Om iti ho vach. Earlier he said Bho, now he says Om. Whereas in Chandogya, he says Anu hi Bhagava iti. The first time he addresses Jaivali, the king, he addresses him as Bhagavan. It's like sir or reverend or revered person. No? And Bho is sort of Bho is an abbreviation of Bhagavan, but Bho has taken on a life of its own, you know, as opposed to Bhagavan. So Anu hi Bhagavan, so he repeats Anu. Yes, he did teach me without doing the whole thing. Okay, so it's a very interesting way of forming an answer. Uses only the prefix, you know. Anu hi Bhagavan, you know, he has done the Anu for me. In Brihadaranyaka you have Om. You probably know that most ancient languages didn't have a word for yes. We take it for granted today, right? Even in Latin and I think in Greek too. You're a Greek person. Is there a Greek yes? I mean, just like that. There are ways of saying yes, of course. No.
Yeah.
Whereas in Sanskrit there wasn't a single word. There's maybe you'd say tatha or something like that. Okay, there may be many ways. And Om, what's his name in Finland?
Parpola
has written a long article on Om that deals with this. I do it a little bit with. In page 59, and I just read that a little bit. The subtle irony of the question is, as expected, lost on the brash Shvetaketu, who replies with a curt yes. The Anushishto, he doesn't understand this little dig on him. So he says, again without any honorific title, Parpola has shown the widespread use of Om as a particle of assent, even outside the ritual context. In the ritual context, it is more common to have Om. I'm not sure whether in the normal usage, Om was used to say yes by an inferior to a superior. The use of Om, however, is quite rare in conversations, in contrast to the ubiquitous Tatha. Given its rarity, its usage was possibly marked and carried a particular connotation. In any case, this curt answer stands in sharp contrast to the obsequious Anuhi Bhagava iti of C. So it's unclear whether Om is, but the marked, and Stephanie Jameson has talked about this marked things, you know, certain things are marked, carries a particular meaning. You know? So Om may have been something like that here. And he, so that's that. And we can see just anticipate if you go to 8 and 10, how he just says, no, iti ovacha. No, haiva iti ovacha. So he has this way of being very curt, you know, no sir, or something, you know. So he says, and then Om then could come within that context, you know, and not saying anything, you know, not being courteous, not being respectful to them. Okay, so that's sort of the early part. Okay, now we come to a series of questions. This is sort of the meat of the argument. So this sets the scene. Now these questions are cut across all three versions here, although the Kaushitika version has just one question, while the other two have five questions, corresponding to the later, the five fires doctrine. So it's the five comes in. Five is a sacred number in the Brahmana literature. Of course, probably as a totality, probably coming from five fingers as a hand, as a totality of number. There are five kinds of sacrifices, especially in the sacrificial context. Five is a full number, like a like three often is a full number. Okay, so we can go to seven there. Veta yatha imaha prajaha pra yatyo vi pratipadyanta iti. Again, prolated there. Do you know how these creatures, imaha prajaha, pra yatyo, when they depart, pra with yam or anything to go, always mean, I mean, often means death, right? Like preta, you know, you get the word preta, the same kind of thing. So as they depart, as they go from this world, vi prati padyante, they go in different ways, vi prati. In other words, they don't have the same road to travel. This is sort of the introduction of the Pitrayana and the Devayana of later times. Okay. When you have the sea, it's much brief. You know, Veta yad ito adhi prajaha prayantiti. Do you know where from here the creatures go, prayanti, depart. Nothing much there, I think, to except that that Brihadaranyaka always already anticipate the two parts in Chandogya. It is not anticipated, and another reason why Renata thinks that this is the older, you know, version being represented here. When you come to Kaushitaki, on the other hand, we are coming now from three, you know, Gautamasya Putra, Asti, Sangvratam, Loke Asmin, Ma Dhasyasi, Anyatamo Va Adva, Tasya, Ma Aloke Dhasyati. Asti Sangvratam, Loke Yasmin, Ma Dhasyati. Is there a closed door? Or a closed thing, sangvrata. This is not that door is not there, but it's something closed. Yas, loke yasmin, in which world? Madhasi, you will place me. You must realize that he is supposed to perform a sacrifice now. At the end of the sacrifice is that the yajamana, the person who performed the sacrifice, is placed in a world, loka. Loka is a very difficult concept in the early period of Indian history of this time. It doesn't mean the same as it means later time, which means the world or something like that. Loka, loka has meaning such as a livable area, which would mean area with where fertility takes place. Gonda has written a whole book on the concept of loka in early period. So I don't want to go into that, but it's a loka is interesting. But loka is where go to aloka would mean you have no space. Yeah, and think of Indra's feat of separating the sky from the earth. If the sky was like this, there's no living space. Right? It's when it goes like that, that you have this space. It's sort of it has a physicality to it, you know, but at the same time it gives that impression. So he says, is there a closed place? You must realize here the thing about a door which is closed, which opens when you go and asks questions. I mean, you find that in Kaushitiki, you know, the very first chapter, you are asked various questions, and when you question, you are allowed to pass through. You know? And this is something like that here. Anyatamo va advha tasya, or is there another way there? Ma aloke dhasyati, lest you place me in an aloka. So he's asking whether he knows what the heck he's doing in terms of the ritual. You know, his problem is this young kid has come to perform sacrifice for him. So that's what. Is that okay? Yeah. When you go to 8, it's simple. Neti hovacha in the Brihadaranyaka. He says no, simply no. We talked about that again. In Chandogya, na bhagava iti, no. My lord. And in Kaushitaki, there's only one question, to which it sahovacha, and he said, meaning Shvetaketu says, naham etad veda. I do not know that. And that's a very simple question, answer. It doesn't have the kinds of marks you have in the other two, in the reply. Kaushitaki is a very much underdeveloped storyline. It just says something. There is no real development of story telling here, and therefore it's difficult to really know what he's contributing to this story here. Okay, at 9 we go to the second question. Veto actually mean vetu. The u is a old Vedic particle of some kind of affirmative, something like a small version of eva. Something I think it may have in this context, something like at least do you know. He had asked one, he didn't know. At least do you know this. Yatha imam lokam punar apadyanta iti. Do you know how they come or return? Punar apadyanti. Return? Imam lokam, to this world. So how do they go after death and how do they come back to this world? In the Chandogya, it's again brief. Veta yatha punar avartante. Instead of apadyante, you have avartante, which is a common, more common term, avrut, which is a circular kind of thing. And he doesn't use the word word apadyante. Is that okay? Yeah. It's a simple kind of thing. 10 is the same, neti hovacha, na bhagavati. So two things exactly corresponding. Then the third, vetta'u yatha asau lokaha evam bahubihi punaha punaha prayadbihi na sampuryate. Do you know how that word, asau loka, yam and asava is very interesting for those who are Sanskritists here. These are what we call deictic pronouns. Deictic pronouns are the ones that are used in conversation, not in written form. In written form, they don't mean nothing. If I'm trying to tell you, that window, immediately it's over there and my finger is pointing. That's asava. Asava is far away. Asava loka over there. And yam will be right down here. Yam loka. Yam prativi. Sometimes just say yam, and we have to, in English translation, you have to put earth, okay? And yam would mean just this, and asa would mean that, The very feminine and the masculine indicates the two spheres. So, veta asau loka, evam bahubihi. In this manner, by many, bahubihi, punaha, prayadbihi, by a lot, going there again and again. So many people go, die, and go to the other world. how it is not filled up. I mean, if you think of this in a spatial way, you can understand, you know, how so many people are coming into the same place and why it is not filled up. Yeah. Now, Veta Pathor Devayanasya Pitriyanasya Cha Vyavartana. Now, that's a different question here you have. This question is given in Brihadaranyaka as the fifth question. Later on we will see under 15, right? So do you know how the paths to the gods and to the fathers take different turns or go there separate ways, vyavartana, something like what we had in the very first question of the Brihadaranyaka. Okay? So from after number two, we find the question, numbering of the questions differ in the two versions. In 12, you have the similar thing. No, Neti Hovacha, no, and Nagabhagava, no, same kind of, so it continues with that. In 13, Vetta U Yatityam Ahudyam Hutayam Apaha Purusha Vacho Bhutva Sam Uthaya Vadanti iti. So do you know then Yatityam Ahutyam Hutayam, in which Ahuti oblation Hutayam, when it's offered, hutayam, apaha, waters, purushavato bhutva, taking on the voice of a human, samuttaya, standing up, getting up, vadanti, speaks. So this is sort of a riddle. But here for the first time you find the ahuti coming in. No? So the whole, the sacrificial terminology is being used here. In Chandogya, we have the number 3 that we already saw. Veta yata asau loka na sampuryante. Do you know how the other world is not filled up? So number 3 here. 14 is the same. There's no. And 15, the final one here. Quite long in Brihadaranyaka, rather short in Chandogya. In the Chandogya, this is number 4. Of the Brihadaranyaka, we can read that first because it's shorter. Chandogya, Veta Yatha Panchamyam Ahutau Apaha Purusha Vachaso Bhavanti. Do you know how in the fifth, now the fifth is introduced, the other one is just asking generally, in the fifth Ahuti, in the fifth offering, waters take on the speech of a human being. That's all. In the Brihadaranyaka, under 15, long one, that we had in Chandogya as a number, under number 11. Veta u devayanasya va pataha pratipadam pitriyanasya va. So, do you know then the pratipada, the axis I have translated, where the foot, you know, how you put your foot in, pratipadam, devayanasya va pataha pitriyanasya va, of the devayana or the pitriyana, the path of the gods or path of the pitrus or path to the pitrus, you know. Yat kritva Devayanang va pantanang pratipadyante pitriyanang va. Doing which one steps on, gets on to the path leading to the gods or the path leading to the pitrus. Apihina risher vacha Richer Vachaha Shrutam. Have you not heard, for have you not heard the words of the Rishi, the seer? And then this is a sort of a citation of an older statement, older something that is found in the tradition, I assume. Dive Sruti A Shrinavam Pitrunam Aham Devanam Utamartyanam. A bit of a verse here, I mean, just citing of a verse. Two paths mortals have, I have heard, to fathers and to gods. So, Dive Shruti Martyanam. So, two paths of mortals. Ashranavam, I have heard. Pitrunam Devanam, to the fathers and to the gods. Tabhyam, Tabhyam, Idam, Vishvam, Ejat, Sam Eti, Yad Antara Pitaram Mataram Cheti. By these, Tabhyam, travel all that live. Idam Vishvam Ejat, anything, all that moves. Yad Antara Pitaram Mataram Cheti, what that is between the father and the mother, which is again the sky and the earth. Okay, so there are the five questions that have been asked here. In 16 then, the concluding reply of Shvetaketu, Naham Ata Ekanchana Veda Itihovacha. Of these, I do not know a single, he said. In Chandogya, Naiva Bhagava Iti. So he puts the eva at the end of na, saying, not at all, my lord. You know, I didn't know even that. So there's a, sort of a, there's a conclusion now to the to these questions and to the answers with within both. Okay, that much is. So we come now in 17 and 18 to an interesting storyline again, you know, which differ in the two. In 17 in the Brihadaranyaka, he says, Atha enam vasati upamantrayang chakre. Then he upamantrayam chakre, he issued an invitation, vasati, to stay. He says, stay with me, implied meaning I will teach you all this. This is not found in Chandogya, that fatherly invitation of the king. Instead, the king blackguards or puts down the young man here. Atha anu kim anu, now he have shishta here coming up. Atha anu kim anu shishto avochata. So this very anu repeated, you know, after each word. Atha anu, kim anu. Then, how can you call yourself a shishta, anushishta? Right? He uses that. Okay. Yo hi manina veda. Who does not know this? Katam so anushishto bruviteti. How can a man say he is educated? So this is a sort of a ultimate put down of this little boy by the king. In Chandogya, while in Brihadaranyaka we have a much different presentation, you know, of the king. Okay, yeah, nobody has any questions. All right. So the contrast here is very, very interesting.
How does he know all these things? Why does he need then a priest to officiate his?
You ask me a question that is extra literary. I have no idea. I was not there, so we can't. So we that's the problem. We are all. So the question to ask is, why did the authors of these texts present the king as knowing this and the others knowing? That's a better question to ask, you know. Then we can answer it, because then it's a literary question. She asks a historical question, then we have to now get out of the, we have to see historical reality through the lens of this text. And that is possible, but very difficult. Very difficult. Very difficult. If you're asking a literary question, I think that's the problem. Many people think that these are actually historical facts, that kings had certain kinds of knowledge which are represented in the Upanishads. That's an old thing that, it's 100 years old, over 100 years old now in Western scholarship, right? But we have no way of knowing that. We have really no way of knowing that. The only thing we know is that the Upanishads and the Brahmanas often depict in literature kings as having knowledge that the Brahmins didn't have. Then you can ask, what was their intention? Why did they want to do that? Now, you don't have easy answers to that, but you can have answers to that, right? Which we can dispute, different people can. But at least it's a way of, we talked about a little bit last time, I think, about it, right? Was there an advantage for the presenter of this doctrine to say, this is a royal doctrine, right? We Brahmins are presenting this royal doctrine. I do not know. You know, we need to go to the extra historical, dimensions of this. So that's what we have here. Yeah.
No, the king refers to the rishis, so it's not really the king who knows, it's the rishis.
Yes. He says that the rishis, for having not the rishis' words, right? But of course, we do not know who these rishis are. Sure. Of course, mm-hmm.
Whether they are in the king's or in the
exactly. We do not know. But later on, we will see that that the king himself claims that this knowledge did not exist with the Brahmins. Yeah. So that's it's openly declared, And this happens frequently in the Upanishads. And the question, of course, is that why do the Brahmins want to proclaim their ignorance? You think that they wouldn't want to. and so there must be a subtext to this, that we do not know fully. But it clearly cannot be something that is historical meaning out there in the world, but in here within the literature.
Is the implication that the king is part of the Shishta?
Yes.
So
clearly.
Shishta, yes.
Clearly, yeah. Yes. Brahmin is not the Shishta and the no. king is. It doesn't say so, but the implication, of course, is that. Yeah. Yes, of course. I'm coming to the end. Well, it's a good place to stop, actually. Anadritya vasating kumaraha pradrudrava. That's in Brihadaranyaka. Okay? Anadritya vasating, without paying regard to his invitation to stay. So you have the Shvetaketu being viewed as this naughty little boy, who rejects this fatherly invitation. Kumara, I think it's a little bit of a interesting dig on him. No, he's not really a Kumara, right? So the young man, Pradudrava, he ran away. And in the Kaushitaki, there is a parallel. It's just one question, right? He says, I do not know that. Hanta acharyam prachaniti. Okay, I'll ask my teacher, meaning my father. Same thing. It's just a common conversation, right? I do not know that. I'll go and ask my father. Right. So that sort of ends the dialogue between Shvetaketu and the king. Now Shvetaketu has come home from the king's palace, and this is the beginning, and we can read that and leave it for the next time. 19. Sa ajagama pitaram. This is a very simple thing that Brihadaranyaka says. So he ran away and went or came to the father. In Kaushitaki, the third column, saha pitaram asadhya, he having approached his father, and continues with the thing, right? It's sort of a neutral thing. It just came, right? But look at Chandogya. There's a little bit more color there. Saha ayastaha pitur ardham eaya. we talked about last time, his predilection for using the verb, right? Aaya, you know, he came, piturardham, to the side of his father, ayastha, aggrieved, he was crestfallen, he was angry, he was ayas, you know, it's a verb that shows sorrow and anguish and humiliated, because he really was humiliated within the Chandogya thing, you know, because on 17 he was really put down, right? And he comes to the father really, really angry, and that is the setting for his conversation with his own father, which is again somewhat interesting in the two dialogues, which again puts Shvetaketu, according to the Brihadaranyaka, a real, I don't know whether you have it in English, but Americans call him a brat. real, do you have it here too? Brat?
Applied to the children under five, I think we would
call it. Oh, you would call it, but you don't call it a brat, meaning a spoiled little fella. No, okay, you'd call, okay.
You'd call him a brat, yeah. Brat, okay, but yeah. You wouldn't call a teenager
a brat, okay.
You'd call him a...
Nasty little man. Spoiled brat.
But smallest.
Yes. Spoiled brat. Yeah. Americans would call that for any.
Coming to perform a sacrifice, bless him. So that's Paul.
Yes, I don't know what to make of that Kaushitaki introduction yet. How the father could send a young son to perform sacrificial functions when the king had asked him. This whole thing, I think it must come from one storytelling line, which may have other things which would have explained this more. But unfortunately, this particular one, that only one we have, we do not know what to make of that initial sending a little boy to perform a sacrifice. It puts Uddalaka also in a bad light. You know, and how that storyline was spun, we do not have much information in this particular one. Sorry, sir.
How do we know how old he is? Because
we do not know. Yes.
Is this the story after the son of Chandogya 6, where his father instructs him?
Of course, you know, I mean, we cannot connect the two in any historical way.
Yeah.
But he is, if these three text refer to the same incident and the same storyline, it seems, with the Kumara being addressed, etc., that he was young. How young, we do not know, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, how young? Yeah, probably a late teenager, early 20s. I mean, depending on how long you have the brahmacharya, you know, 12 years, let's say, you know, 8 plus 12, 20, you know, whatever number, you know, if you want to put that spin on it. So it's he could be a young man, but clearly not a person you would send to you know, look after the king, you know, maybe a village, small ritual. There seems to be something happening there that the existing version doesn't, you know, illuminate sufficiently for us, I think, to make any sense of it the way Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, we can make some sense, you know. The literary thing is more full.
So then the king cannot expect this young man to officiate his sacrifice.
It looks like it, because he asked us question. He didn't want to employ him without knowing whether this guy had the... You know, Upanishads always say that doing anything, is effective only if you know, ya evang veda,
yeah.
Who knows that? So the knowledge accompanying the action is always fruitful. If you do not know, it doesn't bear any fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, the backdrop to what he's talking about here.
So do we think, I mean, this is a question that will come up later in the text. Do we think the role of the boy is to... has a sort of intergenerational significance, in that not all kings, not all kshatriyas or royal people know these things? It's only a mature king that knows these things. Or is his role
That's difficult to tell, because there are, this is not the only royal who knows stuff. Mm. There are others. Janaka knows it, mm. and Ashwapati knows it. And there are about three or four kings who act the same role, meaning Brahmins come, they ask questions, they don't know what to make of it, so yes. the king now has to instruct them. So that's a sort of this yeah. this trope, you know, that goes on
yes,
all
yes.
the time.
Yeah.
And some of the things the Brahmins should know,
mm.
that they don't.
They don't.
Of course, they know some of it, but that's not the final word.
Yes.
You know, it's the question is, do they know the final word of it?
Mm.
They know some things, but mm. halfway there. You know, like a, you know, high school level, not PhD level
yes.
kind of knowledge.
Yes.
you really need the other one. And it continues that way. This is the most, from a literary point of view, fulsome presentation of it. Because they have a lot of characters, whose characters are well developed at some level. The others are not. I mean, it's just a trope. It's a king, Brahmin comes, and they talk. It's almost like a cookie cutter, you know, kind of thing. This is a little bit more developed. So you have a young person, Shvetaketu, and his father, and the king. So there are three people interacting, and it's a more interesting dialogue here. Yeah. And Shvetaketu, of course, as I said last time, you know. Props up in all sorts of situations, and he seems to have that, like that Devadatta quality, you know, that sort of, you know, things are projected onto him in different ways.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much.
Sorry,
yeah, no, we all have to.